Try 4 weeks of The Spectator absolutely free. And, for this month only, you'll receive a Spectator wireless phone charger. Go to www.spectator.co.uk/charger.
Hello and welcome to Quarinomics, the Spectator series on stories from countries turned upside down by COVID-19. I'm Kate Andrews. Today's podcast features our panel, based around the world, who have selected a story that gives you an inside look at what's happening outside their windows. Silvia Ciarulli Borelli is reporting from Rome, a Milan correspondent for the Financial Times. Jennifer Creary is reporting from Hong Kong, a managing editor of the Hong Kong Free Press. And Nick Gillespie is reporting from New York City, an editor-at-large for Reason magazine. This is the sixth and last episode of the first series of Quarinomics, but we'll be back with Season 2 starting the 2nd of June. If you would like to hear stories and perspectives from a specific country, send your suggestions and recommendations to podcast@spectator.co.uk. Sylvia, Jennifer, Nick, thanks for joining me. I think the stories picked this week really reflect steps forward in tackling the COVID crisis and also some major setbacks. I'll start with what's happening here in the UK. The Sunday Telegraph over the weekend revealed some really positive news about how blood-thinning drugs are now thought to be very helpful in saving the lives of COVID-19 patients. So London specialists in the medical field basically made this breakthrough after discovering that for patients who had very serious cases of coronavirus, many, if not most of them, seemed to be suffering from small blood clots that were filling up in the lungs. And this does help to explain, maybe even largely explain, why patients end up dying of lung failure through lack of oxygen. And so they found through these very high-tech CT scans that if they were able to tackle those blood clots through blood thinners, they would be able to help these patients hopefully recover to a higher success rate. And, you know, this is obviously positive news. It's great news for anybody suffering from the virus now. It's potentially very good news as we move forward and try to come up with more treatments. But it also speaks to a debate that's certainly happening in the UK, and I'm sure elsewhere as well, about whether or not we should be pursuing a vaccine or treatments. Now, many would say you should pursue both, and that's all good and well, but the government in the UK is definitely leaning towards and putting its resources behind getting a vaccine. And whilst that would be incredible, it doesn't totally seem realistic. You know, I pray that my skepticism is shown up and that those who are extremely hopeful for a vaccine prove to be right, but it seems like we might be putting a foot ahead of where we're actually at. We also learned early this week that Oxford University has already linked up with the pharmaceutical company AstraZeneca to produce 30 million vaccine shots by September. But this is for a vaccine that doesn't exist yet. Yes, we are doing trials and more data is expected over the summer, but it could be yet another case of the UK in particular pouring resources into equipment, or in this case, a vaccine that doesn't actually prove necessary or is defunct. It doesn't work. So I'm actually really clinging on to this positive news about treatment, arguably even more so than the vaccine news this week, because if you can find really useful treatments, especially if we get better at testing and tracing the virus and you can target people who contract the virus very quickly, this could be a really positive step in the right direction for helping to treat people with COVID-19.
Yeah, you know, in the U.S., a lot of the conversation about vaccines in particular is that it typically takes years for a vaccine to be developed and tested properly and then kind of put out into the healthcare system. And the early reports that there would be a vaccine within 18 months, that was, you know, that's been kind of revealed to just be somebody's like best, most optimistic guess. It usually takes 3 to 5 years for a vaccine to come through. I'm curious in the UK, Kate, is are people talking about the infection fatality rate much? Because that is one of the topics that is starting to get more discussion in the US, which is out of the number of people who actually are infected with the disease, how many people end up dying? And in the US, it looks like the estimates now that people are settling around is 0.6%, about 0.8%, which is far more deadly than the flu, but is also, you know, it's a number that seems manageable on some level. And that seems to be undergirding some of the willingness, along with people just being frustrated about, you know, actually opening things up.
Interestingly, the number that everybody's focusing on in the UK at the moment is the R number, which is the rate of infection. If you have COVID, how likely are you to spread that to more than one person on average, less than one person on average? You know, our R rate at the moment is below one, but it's absolutely fascinating. In London, there are now thought to be under 30 people a day who are contracting the virus. I mean, it really is under control in certain areas of the UK and really busy metropolitan big areas of the UK. But again, the narrative has shifted, and I think it reflects the nervousness of British residents. It used to be about controlling this virus, and as you say, Nick, what is manageable, what is not. Now it's about eradicating the virus. And of course, again, that's the goal, that's the dream. But that's a very different tactic to getting it under control. And eradicating the virus, as you say, could be years off. Let's hope it's not, but it really could be. And so the government is trying to strike that balance, and at the moment it's not really lining up with the cautiousness of residents.
Yeah, it's interesting because the narrative in Hong Kong is very different from the UK. It's not so much about eradicating the virus. It's because I think there's some acceptance among the public that because Hong Kong is so small and it's, you know, it's a small city and it's an economy that relies on international travel and global business, that there is an acceptance that there will always be people coming in and out of the city, and as a result, we'll always have imported cases. And so the conversation is not so much about, you know, keeping the virus out entirely, but having the capacity to manage any local community outbreaks or, you know, any outbreaks that may happen in the future now that we're well past the peak.
I should say, I mean, I think the government strategy is very much to adopt something like there is in Hong Kong. I think they recognize that we're not going to be able to eradicate it yet, and they want to come up with a track and trace scheme. Their goal is to be able to isolate cases, to isolate clusters, and to be able to crack down heavily there while letting the rest of the UK and, you know, the majority of places get back to some kind of normal. And those plans are underway. We're not anywhere close to it yet. The UK has been quite woeful, actually, in trying to come up with its own scheme, not working with the Apples and Googles of the world with, you know, tried, tested, and rather successful models of what it could look like. But even if we were to get there, again, it's about bringing the public with you. And it's been really remarkable, actually, to see how the British public's attitude has differed from other groups of people around the world. And there is a hesitation here, which the government's going to have to continue to work with the people to come to some kind of agreement about what we consider to be safe and a risk worth taking and what we don't.
Can I ask, Kate, I mean, like you say, there's a kind of distinction or there's daylight between what the government is doing, what the people are doing. How much do you think that the public response is actually heavily conditioned by government policies, not just now, but over the past 20 years or so? One of the stories that has always been coming out of the UK, seriously, for about the past 20 years or so, is the rise of British nanny statism and the infantilization of adults on all sorts of levels, including, you know, trying to get people to quit smoking and eating and blah, blah, blah. But also the rise of closed circuit TV. The UK, you know, has one of the highest rates of surveillance cameras on people. You know, I mean, is this actually kind of a logical conclusion of, you know, decades of the government kind of surveilling and infantilizing, you know, British adults?
That's a really good question, Nick. I think there is an element of that, and obesity has been in the news a lot recently because, well, Public Health England has been under a lot of criticism for putting more resources behind what they call the obesity epidemic, which in some ways feels a bit like a thoughtless term now, rather than planning for actual pandemics. But of course, that's now being turned on its head, and the Prime Minister has said, no, that the real war we have to fight now is obesity, because it does seem to be the case that if you are obese, you are more susceptible to contracting a severe form of COVID. But I think the most successful messaging, which still does kind of speak to your point, has been around the National Health Service. It is the one entity, the one industry in the UK that has been untouchable for decades. I mean, that's true now, especially as the doctors and nurses have handled the crisis so well as individuals, but it's been true for a long time. And that messaging of stay home, protect the NHS, I think really cut through for people, but arguably too well, because there is this reverence around the NHS. People stop going. A&E has plummeted, cancer treatment has plummeted, and there are now doctors and nurses who are saying, we're getting very concerned that very sick people have stayed home because of this mantra of protect the NHS. So yes, I do think that's built in a bit. The nannying nature of the UK government has been on the rise, as you say. But I think that there are multiple things going on there, not just around, say, our attitude towards obesity, but also how one accesses healthcare and what you feel you're entitled to. But as said, the news about the treatment is pretty positive. I'd say a step forward. Unfortunately, Nick, you have brought to the table this week a setback from an article in the Business Insider lays out how the FDA is cracking down on some efforts to tackle COVID. So tell us about that.
Yes. So the FDA is the main federal organization that oversees a wide variety of medical devices, as well as drugs and pharmaceuticals. And they get to sign off on what tests are allowed under what circumstances for all sorts of things, but particularly COVID-19. And there had been Seattle, Washington State in the Pacific Northwest was the place where COVID-19 first really presented itself in a big way in the United States. And it's also where Microsoft is, Bill Gates' former company. And in Seattle, there was a test that came out of Bill Gates' philanthropy or had been backed by it. It's not like Bill Gates came up with it or anything, but it was a test for coronavirus. And it was being used in the Seattle area. About 300 people a day were being tested. And the FDA has now said that they have to stop doing that. And the sticking point is that the test, which is it's a live test to see if people have it, but it was that the FDA makes a distinction between different types of tests. There's a surveillance test, which is used by medical researchers to see the extent of infection and rates and things like that. And then there is a diagnostic test where the results are shared with doctors and patients in particular. And the FDA has shut down this process by which a Seattle group was testing 300 people a day for this to try and get a better sense of what was going on. And they were sharing the information with the doctors and the patients. So the FDA said, you know, you can't do that anymore. And they shut it down. As they had shut down originally, they had shut down kind of competing tests. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which is the federal agency that was, its entire mission is to anticipate and stop pandemics. And it massively failed, but they had maintained a monopoly on testing early on. And then they actually rolled out a test that was faulty, and it just took weeks to get past all of that. The FDA at various points has opened up the testing process to various people. But this latest skirmish where it kind of cuts across is people want more and more information. Individuals want more and more information. And in the United States, I think there is an ongoing and developing kind of debate over whether or not public health authorities are the ones who get to maintain a kind of monopoly on information and then use it to guide policy versus people who are very interested in kind of patient autonomy and the idea that individuals should have as much information about what, you know, first off, whether or not they're infected with something or not, but then also being allowed to kind of generate their own risk assessment. So if we know that the infection rate of COVID is, you know, this percent, and if here are different ways that you may be at higher or lower risk, here are practices you can use like social distancing and masks, do you want to go out and about? And this flex by the FDA to kind of shut down something which was a local, positive, and popular program just seems to kind of, it's a skirmish on a kind of battle line that is only going to get bigger and bigger, both as the coronavirus pandemic goes on, but also once we're past that, because so much in the United States now is being geared towards medical help or medical kind of treatments that you do in your own house, you do on your own time, and you're kind of deciding what you want as opposed to the government, you know, going to a government hospital, much less a government service or something like that.
Yeah, it's really interesting because in Hong Kong, the sentiment is very different because there is certainly a sense that the government has a responsibility to ensure the public have access to adequate testing measures, adequate quarantine facilities. There's actually a phrase that the government has been peddling for several months now. It just means together we fight the virus, Tong Sam Kong. It basically means that it's essentially trying to engender this sense of solidarity among Hong Kongers who have for months been very fractured because of the protests. You know, you have families that are torn apart, communities that are torn apart, and there are very, very deep divisions within the community. And so I think this one phrase was basically intended to get the community to come together. But it's interesting because the public, while there is a sense that they want the government to take the initiative and to basically, you know, close borders, ensure that there are enough adequate anti-epidemic measures, in the same breath, they're saying, well, actually, we don't trust the government. And there is this division between, you know, not trusting the people who basically create these social distancing measures while also trusting the health authority, which is under the government. So there's this inherent contradiction, which is very different from, I think, in other countries.
Nick, I mean, when the FDA is acting at its best, it really has public health in mind. It's what, you know, in theory could stop an individual from thinking that they're having a Coke, but actually they're drinking rat poison. But in the Business Insider article, it flags that the issue here seems to be very bureaucratic. It's a categorization issue. So they've stopped testing more or less indefinitely so that people can fill out the right paperwork. I mean, that's what really grates, isn't it? It's not that they think that something dangerous is happening, but that the right boxes haven't been ticked.
Right. And, you know, this is one of a kind of sub thread that's coming through the kind of U.S. response is there's more and more indications, you know, that the government is saying, you know, they put in place certain policies and that's what matters. There's a counter argument that, for instance, if you look at when people stopped going out, and there's various kinds of data sets that suggest when people stopped going to restaurants, when they stopped leaving their apartments as much, it all started before the official lockdowns happened. And it was a result of people being informed of what the risks were and how to combat the virus. And so that you saw before the government put into place certain types of things, Americans had kind of collectively shut down the economy out of concern for their safety. And it's kind of fascinating to think about that it wasn't really the government that shut down the economy, although it certainly has in other ways. And it leads to a question of, okay, who has the ability to open up the economy? Because one of the flip sides of all of this stuff that's going on now is that a number of states in the U.S. have opened up parts of their economy again. The types of stores that are allowed to be legally operating and whatnot has expanded in places like Texas, Florida, and Georgia. And so far, at least, it's only been about 2 weeks in, but it, you know, that's within the gestation period. There haven't really been any kind of reported big outbreaks of any things like that. So, you know, in the U.S., a lot of this stuff is always going to be, you know, the government makes a lot of rules, oftentimes bureaucratic and arbitrary. And in the U.S., as I think in other places, we were being told almost on a daily basis, you know, don't wear masks. Masks don't do anything. You must wear masks or, you know, whatever. I mean, there's a lot of contradictory information coming from the top. And, you know, there's always this battle between who is actually controlling how we live and things like that. And this just kind of muddies it. The FDA has been famous for, you know, the idea that the only reason why Coca-Cola or restaurants or pharmaceutical companies don't kill all of their customers is because the FDA is, you know, making sure that they're honest actors. I don't think a lot of people really buy that because it's clear that there are always bad actors in an economy and in a medical space and things like that. But generally speaking, that, you know, big corporations that have a lot to lose if they start putting out poison, they're going to be policing themselves pretty well. And there are other kinds of ways of making sure that products are safe and efficacious.
I think in retrospect, the FDA is thought to be one of the villains when it came to combating the HIV/AIDS epidemic.
Yeah, in a movie like The Dallas Buyers Club, which came out, you know, almost 10 years ago, I guess, very much showed that the FDA was insisting as people were dying and no relief was on the horizon, the FDA went out of its way to shut down anybody who was kind of experimenting on the margins, even though the alternative was an immediate death sentence.
And it's an interesting comparison. I guess we'll find out in retrospect if the FDA redeemed itself during this crisis or acted in a similar way. Well, from confusing and conflicting information on one side of the world to interesting new guidance, or I suppose an interesting update on the other side of the world, Jennifer, I would say that this is a step forward for Hong Kong, the news that you've picked out of the South China Morning Post. A lot of people around the world, a lot of governments seem to think that if cases start rising again, that inevitably means another lockdown, but not so in Hong Kong. Tell us the details.
Yeah, that's right. And I think this leads nicely on from your story in that it kind of signals a change in the way that Hong Kong authorities are approaching the coronavirus. So the story I picked out was one talking about last Wednesday, where health authorities recorded three new locally transmitted infections. So these three people belong to the same family. And this happened after 23 consecutive days of only imported cases, so infected patients coming in from overseas. So this is pretty significant because the week before we saw this kind of celebratory moment where the city was on the brink of declaring itself free of local cases after 28 days. So this is the equivalent of two incubation periods. And as a result, the government relaxed various social distancing measures and allowed certain businesses to reopen with restrictions. We talked about this last week. But now we have these new local infections that have an unknown origin. So none of these patients have a travel history, which essentially raises the possibility of asymptomatic carriers in the community. And all of these infected patients, with the exception of the youngest, who is the 5-year-old granddaughter of the other two, basically interact with their community on a daily basis. But it's interesting because the article notes several medical experts who basically say that this isn't necessarily a cause for concern and that sporadic community infections may just become the new normal. And this is really in line with a shift, I'd say, in how the world is coming to view its future relationship with the coronavirus. So this is one that's not necessarily based on eliminating the threat entirely, but kind of coexisting with it. And I think this logic was echoed by health authorities in Hong Kong. So representatives from the Center for Health Protection last week said that they agreed with the World Health Organization's view that the coronavirus may simply never be eradicated. I think it was the WHO's Director of Emergencies, Michael Ryan, who basically likened COVID-19 to other endemic viruses like HIV that humans have just had to, you know, learn to live with. And so this approach is mirrored in how the government has adopted a strategy which they've dubbed the suppress and lift strategy. So this is when social distancing measures are repeatedly relaxed and then tightened to cope with any fluctuations or changes in the risk level. So the article notes a nightclub district in Seoul in South Korea, which saw a cluster of new infections and basically caused local authorities to push back some of the social distancing measures. So I think this is the kind of strategy that Hong Kong is hoping to mirror. So, you know, going back to these three new infections, essentially health authorities say that there's no immediate need to retighten restrictions. If anything, the government has been mooting the possibility of creating something called a travel bubble between Macau and Guangdong, that's in the mainland. So those are both areas that are reporting a slowdown in the growth of the number of coronavirus cases. And this system will essentially use a health code to determine whether or not individuals crossing the border need to be in quarantine, that kind of stuff. So it's interesting to note how this narrative or this conversation has shifted from, you know, as we were saying before, trying to get rid of the virus entirely to basically adapting to it. And so bearing in mind, you know, it's very optimistic, as I was saying before, to assume that imported cases can be eradicated entirely. And I think the general consensus is that, well, life must go on in Hong Kong and, you know, schools are meant to reopen on May the 28th. And the government hasn't indicated any changes to this current plan so far.
I'm always fascinated and very often envious of your updates, Jennifer, because the fact that there is a nightclub district that's open in Hong Kong is just baffling to me here in the UK. And I've seen a lot of videos on social media of people at the beach, people in restaurants. It might look a little different. There might be a plastic partition somewhere. There might be more masks on show than before. But it really feels like people in Hong Kong are enjoying life again.
Yeah, so I think there's an interesting dichotomy because There's an argument that because, I mean, protests have flared up again in Hong Kong, some people are arguing that, well, the police aren't really enforcing social distancing measures in nightclub districts because there are still social distancing measures. The maximum number of people who are allowed to gather in a public place in a singular group is 8 people. But we don't often see that enforced in nightclub districts. But then when you see protests in shopping malls, in the streets, you know, there are dozens, hundreds of riot police who are immediately at hand to issue fines. And it's interesting because I think the coronavirus is really, it's not really dominating local media so much anymore. It's more about our own political woes. We have, you know, fights in the legislature that really we wouldn't have seen a few months ago. So it's interesting to see how people are, it's COVID-19 is still in the mind of many Hong Kongers. You know, people are, 90% of the population is still wearing masks. But oftentimes you see people, it kind of slipping in and out of people's consciousness, I think.
That's, you know, in the United States, another kind of argument that is starting to come to the fore is that we were told originally that the goal was to flatten the curve, not to eradicate the virus, but to minimize the number of cases at any given moment so that the health system could process them. And flattening the curve merely means, in its purest form, it doesn't reduce the number of deaths or hospitalization. It just spreads it out over a longer period of time so that hospitals and doctors and medical workers can deal with people. And at some point, once that was achieved, and we've talked about this in past episodes, where places like New York, which were bracing for massive numbers of people who were going to be on respirators or ventilators, and it turned out to be much less than that, the rhetoric now among many public health people is we have to stop people from being infected. And, you know, people here are talking a lot about shifting the goalposts, and that if the goal is not to be infected, really the only thing we can do is have an indeterminate lockdown or a permanent lockdown until a vaccine is found. And people are starting to question that a lot because, again, you know, I think we're all going through some level of fatigue with this. And that shift, I mean, I found it really interesting in that article that Hong Kong is talking about how do you live with a persistent virus. You know, this is also something in the U.S. where we're used to doing it with things like measles, we're used to doing it with things like HIV, which is a little bit different because, you know, it's more controllable whether or not you get it. It's not quite the same type of disease as something like COVID. But, you know, that I think is where the argument is going to be going, which is what are good practices to minimize the risk? What determines a big enough flare up where you're going to say, okay, we're actually going to lock down a little bit more? But definitely we're arguing over whether we have to wait until nobody can get sick from COVID or what is an acceptable amount of kind of danger and risk.
I agree with Nick, and it feels like in Italy, the government has completely shifted gears. And while initially they were trying to be very, very prudent and wait until the infection rate was zero, now I think they realize people are fatigued and also the economy is taking a very bad hit from this extended lockdown, and they've really accelerated reopening businesses. I told you last week they were planning on reopening hairdressers and beauty salons on June 3rd, but in fact, they opened yesterday. And so have restaurants, not only for takeout, but also to dine in. And on June 3rd now, they're going to allow international travel without quarantine obligations. So it really feels like at this point, the Italian government, although this is one of the most severely hit countries in Europe, is trying to find ways to counterbalance the health emergency with the economic impact and with the social impact.
I'm sensing a real divide here between the way that Western countries are handling this new phase of the pandemic and countries like Hong Kong. And I wonder if part of that speaks to the politics. I mean, because here in the UK, as I said, the goalpost has shifted as well. That's something the US, UK, and Italy all seem to have in common. Whereas in Hong Kong, there's much more of an acceptance that this is now with us, but we're going to figure out how we go about living our lives. And I mean, here in the UK, there's definitely a sense that there's a public inquiry coming. There's going to be so much scrutiny over the government's handling of this. They now feel like every single death could very much be pointed at them as their fault because they didn't handle something properly along the way. And Jennifer, I wonder if you think that the political dynamic in Hong Kong and perhaps the fact that you wouldn't see an inquiry in the same way might, in a very strange way, be making it a little bit easier for Hong Kong to liberalize. Do you think there's anything in that?
I think there are two points that need to be made. I think the first one being is that Hong Kong is it's a lot smaller than the other countries that are in this, that they're talking about. You know, it's got a population of 7 million people and it's largely very manageable. So, you know, that's an important point to consider. And secondly, Hong Kong has experience because I've talked about this in the past, but the SARS outbreak in 2003 is really the only reference point that Hong Kongers have in dealing with a contagion on this scale. And in retrospect, Tung Chee Hwa's administration, Tung Chee Hwa being the chief executive at the time, failed to react quick enough, hence why the virus killed nearly 300 people in Hong Kong. But now we have the Center for Health Protection, which was set up directly in response to SARS in 2004. And that is the body that has been praised for its contact tracing and its fastidiousness. So this outbreak really changed the psyche of Hong Kongers. And so when COVID-19 hit, the reaction from the public and the demands that the public made to the government was almost like a reflex reaction. And because the government had been under such public scrutiny, you know, domestically, locally, and internationally, I think it felt like it was under the spotlight to react in a very quick way. And because it had this experience with SARS, it was able to do so. In terms of your point about an inquiry into the government, I mean, we look at what happened initially in Hong Kong, whereby the medics had to go on strike to call for a full border closure to get any reaction from the government. And that really put pressure on the local authorities. But of course, there was some tussle and Carrie Lam's administration said that, you know, we're not going to give in. This is a brute strategy. You know, we're not going to. But eventually they did impose some restrictions. And as a result, you know, Hong Kong has fared relatively well. So I'm not sure if there's definitely public scrutiny when it comes to how the government has handled it. But I think that is largely because of how it really messed up SARS in 2003.
That's a really interesting way to look at it. Hong Kong, in many ways, has already gone through its public inquiry. Let's move back across the world to our last story this week. Sylvia, I'm sad to say that you are with Nick in sharing a story that is not a step forward, but really a setback. This story is in The Local. Tell us about it.
Yes, the article in The Local is about rising poverty in Italy as a consequence of the coronavirus pandemic. Now that we're exiting the health emergency, at least for the short term, the focus in Italy is very much shifting to the economic impact of the lockdown. And as I was saying just minutes ago, it's obviously huge. The story describes how demand for free meals served by one charity in Rome spiked recently. It narrates how one evening there were a couple hundred people lining up for their bag of food, and some were left disappointed because the 130 meals were gone within 10 minutes. And one woman standing in line tells the reporter she was embarrassed to be there, but she had to stop buying food in order to pay for her rent, and that she normally worked as a cleaner, but she had to stop working when the lockdown came into force. So this woman's problem, I think, is really representative of many people's problem in Italy, because unfortunately, many low-skilled workers here don't have proper contracts. And if they don't work, essentially they don't get paid and they don't have the right to access furlough or unemployment schemes. And many of them don't have any family support or savings. The article mentions an April forecast from the OECD, according to which 27% of Italians could fall into poverty were they to forego 3 months of income. So while the government has repeatedly stated that it doesn't want to leave anybody behind because of the structural problems within Italy's labor market. Many people are indeed being left behind. And this, I think, is worth pointing out, isn't just the case of people who work illegally, but also contractors, freelancers, and workers on fixed-term contracts, especially in the tourism and hospitality industries who have lost their jobs and have no income whatsoever since this pandemic began. Even people, older people, who rely on minimum pensions and they work part-time to pay their bills or for their other needs like food or medicine. So, you know, before the coronavirus crisis in Italy, there were about 5 million individuals living in poverty. Now, there are estimates that this number could have increased by 1 million over the past 2 months. Since these poor people are especially living in the south, which, as I was saying last week, is a part of the country that heavily relies on the tourism industry. The government is scrambling to find ways to help these people. And although they have given some sort of support through food stamps, through cheap loans, and essentially by lifting these lockdown restrictions, as I was saying, faster than initially planned, on the one hand, the support that was given by the government isn't sufficient to address everyone's needs. And on the other hand, the question is whether people will actually be persuaded it's safe to go out, travel, go to a restaurant. And I'm wondering how this is going down elsewhere, because I'm pretty sure this labor and rising poverty issue is not just an Italian one.
In the United States, you know, the unemployment rate last month officially is tabbed at about 15%, and that's almost certainly an undercount. And this is really the question. The government has spent already about $5 trillion in total to stabilize the economy just over the past 2 months. And there's more in the pipeline that's going to be coming. And I think, to go back to what I was talking about, where in the U.S. it's becoming apparent that the government is not in control of a switch that flips the economy off or on. And that's the real million-dollar question of how long is the recession that we're in going to last? Because in places like Georgia, in places like Texas, Florida, other states that have reopened either all or part of their economy, there's still a tremendous slowdown. Georgia was one of the first states to reopen in a semi-big way. And restaurant traffic is down 86% from where it was a year ago. So, you know, and that's after opening up for a couple of weeks. So I think you're right. This is going, I think it's going to, at least in some countries, it's going to start shifting from a public health discussion to an economic discussion. And who the hell knows what's going to happen.
Sylvia, I wanted to ask, is there any indication that this will perhaps spark, I don't want to say a popular uprising, but at least some pushback from the public in terms of protests, especially the way that the government has handled this?
I do think so. The article mentions this as one possibility. I'm not sure if Italians at this point will really be keen on taking to the streets and, you know, determining a popular uprising. But at the same time, because Italy has a coalition government and there have been talks about the government collapsing during this crisis because of the divisions within the government and within the parties that make up the ruling coalition, I really do think it will eventually lead to political change, especially because the crisis here in Italy, I think, will be quite long. Forecasts say that for Italy to get back to its pre-crisis economic levels, it will take at least 3 or 4 years. And already before this crisis, the economy was barely growing. So I think we're in for the long run here. And the government will really have to respond to the public, and I wouldn't rule out a general election anytime soon.
Well, this is the really frightening thing, isn't it, Sylvia, is how Italy's economy and jobs market was faring before the crisis. I think you can make quite a strong argument that, especially for young people, the jobs market never really recovered after the financial crash for countries like Italy and Greece and Spain. And it's not obvious it was in a position where it could take another blow. And, you know, this kind of blow is of just absolute epic proportions. We don't know how bad it's going to get. So it feels like we're far past breaking point I mean, this is not a sustainable situation, is it?
Definitely not. And also, I think this situation really calls into question the European Union's role and Italy's role within the European Union, because the main opposition parties are Eurosceptic parties. And one of the governing parties, the Populist Five Star Movement, has also been very critical of the European Union and its rules. And also, before being in government, campaigned in favor of a referendum to exit the single currency. So I think the response by the European Union and by other nations belonging to the European Union will really forge the way forward and really, you know, decide where Italy is headed in the next few years and whether it will take the same direction the UK has taken, although with larger consequences for its economy, but also the Eurozone's economy. But right now, the difficult question is really what other countries and how Brussels intends to support Italy, and whether the rules imposed by Brussels and the economic support measures will help the Italian economy or force Italy to implement tough austerity measures that could actually trigger an entirely different scenario and potentially a new euro crisis like Greece 10 years ago.
Sylvia, you mentioned Greece and the economic crisis or financial crisis that it had a decade ago. Italy has always been a kind of, you know, while it's a big economy, relatively speaking, it's also always been in trouble. And, you know, what is your sense of if the Italian economy really tanks, and obviously everybody's economy everywhere is taking a massive hit, how does that affect Italy's relationship to the EU as well as to other European countries? Because the PIGS countries all seem to be really in bad shape already. And then, you know, a place like Spain is dealing with a spike in COVID cases and things like that. How do you think this plays out outside of Italy itself?
Well, I think it will improve the situation between Italy and its European partners to the extent Northern European countries and countries like France really understand and are sympathetic to Italy's position. Italy right now is trying to negotiate the way forward with the European Union through the recovery fund and potentially the use of the ESM, which is the European bailout arm. But this is something that is very controversial. There are different takes in different countries across Europe. Italy would like free money or grants, and Northern European countries are offering loans. So there's a political debate that I think will really shape Italy's role within the European Union and potentially future clashes. I think this situation is very different to the past euro crisis because everyone is pretty much on the same boat. And as you were saying, Spain and other countries have been deeply affected. But I think if the response isn't united and really European countries decide not to look in the same direction, there could be massive geopolitical changes going forward.
And what about within Italy? You've mentioned over the past couple of weeks, you know, the difference in infection rates as well as between northern and southern Italy. And it seems like the economic downturn is really, you know, hardest hit in the south because it's always been poorer. And yet the infection rates are lower. When do you think that might boil over within Italy?
That's a very good question. And the answer is that I don't know. It also depends how the summer season goes, because I think the reason for the government to decide they will reopen the borders and they will let international travelers in without having to quarantine from June 3rd goes exactly in that direction. It tries to support the tourism industry, which the south of Italy relies upon very heavily. If these tourists don't come and if people decide they aren't going out and they won't travel and they won't move around, I think the differences between the north and the south of the country will really worsen going forward.
Yeah, you know, another test case of that will be Iceland. I was reading Iceland, which has done a fantastic job of minimizing the rate of infection, is set to reopen for tourism, I think, on June 1st or something like that. And they're going to require either a 14-day quarantine or a nasal swab upon entering the country. You know, it'll be interesting to see how tourism, you know, first off, if countries open themselves up for it, and then if anybody goes, given those are probably going to be the conditions that are in place more or less everywhere.
But also, I wonder, in a country like Italy, who will want to come after reading all this press and, you know, being aware of the figures and the numbers of deaths and the big outbreak the country has suffered? Will tourists want to go on holiday in Italy this year? And I doubt it, actually.
Well, and if who has money to travel, you know, in a way? Because if, you know, in the U.S., you know, with so many people unemployed, I suspect any, you know, a lot of people who might have been thinking about traveling anywhere just aren't going to be doing it.
There's no doubt a battle gearing up between governments that want to recruit tourists to their shores this summer and governments that will do everything they can to stop people from getting on those planes. One to watch, and one that I'm sure we'll be discussing on Series 2 of Coronomics, which launches on June 2nd. But for now, I'd like to thank Nick, Sylvia, and Jennifer, not just for today's podcast episode, but for the 5 previous ones, and for being such a fantastic panel and providing such great insight on Series 1 of Coronomics. You can catch up with the first series and get ready to listen to the second by subscribing to Spectator Radio. And you can subscribe to the Spectator magazine at spectator.co.uk/subscribe. And if you're listening in the US, spectator.us/subscribe. And you can use the discount code KATE. Thanks for listening.
Try 4 weeks of The Spectator absolutely free. And for this month only, you'll receive a Spectator wireless phone charger. Go to www.spectator.co.uk/charger.